Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ben Jealous, president of People for the American Way, who talks about his group's effort to stop the Senate from confirming President Trump's nominee to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg before a new president is sworn in. Lisa Tucker of the group Consumer Watchdog, who talks about why, during devastating wildfires across California, environmental and climate groups are pressuring Governor Gavin Newsom to ban fossil fuel fracking. And Trita Parsi, co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, who examines growing concern that the Trump regime may be trying to provoke a military confrontation with Iran before the November election. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
While leaders of Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates came to the White House last week to formalize their nation's normalization of relations with Israel, the heart of the deal appears to be the Trump administration's pledge to sell advanced F-35 stealth fighter jets to the UAE. The proposed arms sale, which comes before Congress in October, is raising concern among some security experts in Israel that the Middle East could be on the verge of a dangerous new arms race, even as Bahrain, the UAE, and Israel sign a peace deal. If the F-35 sale goes forward, there's an increasing likelihood that Israel and other Middle East countries will in turn seek more advanced arms. The UAE has been increasingly aggressive in its military interventions across the Middle East, with missions aligned with the Trump administration in Iraq, Libya, Syria, and Yemen. Under the Obama administration, the UAE couldn't get a classified briefing on the F-35 stealth fighter. But now under the Trump regime, arms sales to Arab allies like the UAE and Saudi Arabia are a top priority. Meanwhile, Israel's military leaders are making a shopping list for advanced U.S. military weapons systems, including V-22 Osprey jets. According to a report by the National Campaign Against Torture, an Indian rights group based in New Delhi, more than 1,700 people were killed while in police custody last year. The majority of the victims, the report said, were Muslims and lower caste Hindus, who are frequent targets of discrimination and violence. The murder of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis in May provoked massive protests around the U.S. and the world, but not in India, where no large grassroots movement has emerged to take on police brutality. The New York Times reports that for many Indians, day-to-day crime is a more pressing issue, and they often side with the police, even when there is documented evidence that officers have abused their power. There is also a great fear of speaking out against the police. Indian human rights groups say there has not been a single conviction of an officer in the deaths of 500 people alleged to have been tortured while in custody between 2005 and 2018. In the state of Uttar Pradesh, which is notorious for suspicious police killings, magistrates have investigated 74 deaths since March 2017. In every case, the officers were cleared. In the early weeks of the COVID-19 pandemic, the meatpacking industry was facing a rising number of public health orders to shut down plants in order to protect workers from contracting the virus. But under pressure from meatpacking companies, President Trump issued an executive order to keep the meatpacking plants open to secure America's food supply. But emails obtained by ProPublica show that the meat industry may have had a hand in its own White House rescue. Just a week after the order was issued, the meat industry's trade group drafted an executive order that bears striking similarities to the one the president signed. The executive order effectively provided a justification, sanctioned by the White House, for meat companies to continue operations, even as tens of thousands of the industry's workers contracted the virus and more than 200 died since March. Only recently has the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration imposed modest fines on meatpacking companies, Smithfield Foods and JBS, for health violations in their plants. Mark Lauriston of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union blasted OSHA for turning a blind eye on the health crisis in the plants for months, and said he believes the sudden issuance of fines months after the plants were spiking with coronavirus cases is motivated by covering their tracks before the upcoming election. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Feminist icon Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who fought most of her life for women's and LGBTQ rights, passed away at the age of 87 after serving 27 years on the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Ginsburg, who died on September 18th after a long battle with cancer, was celebrated in life as the notorious RBG for issuing tough dissenting opinions against an increasingly conservative Supreme Court. Before being nominated as a federal appeals court judge in 1980, Ginsburg served as director of the Women's Rights Project of the American Civil Liberties Union, where she took on hundreds of gender discrimination cases, winning 5 of 6 landmark cases before the Supreme Court. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell infamously justified his decision not to give President Obama's Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland a hearing or vote after Justice Scalia died in February 2016, 9 months before Election Day, saying no high court nominee should be considered in a presidential election year. But now he and the Republican Senate intend to do just that by holding a vote on President Trump's nominee to replace Justice Ginsburg just 6 weeks before the November 3rd election. Your reporter spoke with Ben Jealous, president of People for the American Way, who previously served as president and CEO of the NAACP. Here he discusses the campaign being launched by dozens of progressive groups across the nation to stop the GOP-controlled Senate from considering any nominee proposed by President Trump until after the election and a new president takes office in January 2021.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg, like Thurgood Marshall before her, was a great warrior for justice long before she became a Supreme Court justice. And that's why the notorious RBG, as my 14-year-old daughter calls her, is such a treasure to so many in our country, so deeply respected and so missed. We are very much in the moment. The Republicans wasted no time in dishonoring her memory, even though she died on Rosh Hashanah, sacred holiday, when people are celebrating the new year and celebrating all good things. There was Mitch McConnell dishonoring her memory. Donald Trump has already accelerated even before her funeral, finding her successor, fueled by special interests, trying to push through another extreme right justice before this election, even though the voting process has already begun in several states. And so that's where we are right now, and we're just going to have to rise to this moment.
As most of our listeners are aware, Mitch McConnell infamously justified his decision not to give Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland a Senate hearing or a vote after Justice Scalia died in 2016, 9 months before the presidential election that year, saying that no nominee to the Supreme Court should be considered in a presidential election year. Now, weeks before the November 3rd election, Mitch McConnell and many of his Republican Senate colleagues plan to go forward on Trump's Supreme Court nominee, disregarding their 2016 precedent. It just seems like such blatant hypocrisy. You hope that there's accountability in this world for that kind of dishonesty. But I'm losing hope day by day. What are some of your thoughts on the penalty, if any, for this blatant kind of hypocrisy that we're seeing here by the Republicans?
Well, look, first of all, we cannot allow Mitch McConnell to rope-a-dope us into believing that we are powerless. We only need 4 Republicans to join a coalition of conscience with the Democrats, we already definitely have two, Collins and Murkowski.
Right.
And then there's a long list of possible targets for that. And we at People for the American Way, we are building movements in Iowa, Colorado, Arizona, South Carolina, other folks we're working with. They're building movements in North Carolina, Maine, Tennessee, all targeting A or both senators in that state, and one or both senators in that state. Hold them to their word, to push them towards their better angels, to convince them they simply won't win their election, or in the case of Lamar Alexander in Tennessee, won't have the legacy that they hope to have if they don't do the right thing in this moment. And the only way you can insert steel into the backbone of a senator is through the people of his state, people of her state. And so that's why we're building movements in these states. We're hiring new organizers, linking them with old organizers. You know, in the case of South Carolina, I mean, we will be running ads with those words.
Ben Jealous, if the worst case scenario should occur and a right-wing judge is confirmed by the U.S. Senate before the election, there are some people out there that are advising the Democrats, if they should win the White House and win the Senate, to do what Franklin Delano Roosevelt did in 1937 and add some more justices to the Supreme Court to rebalance what many view as a very unfair situation, given what Mitch McConnell has done in 2016 and may go forward on doing this year. What's your view of packing the court?
You know, right now, all options should be on the table. With that said, we need to stay focused. We need to stay disciplined, build the movements in these states. We should not put our kind of tie our hopes to an idea that would require a number of things to fall into place to even be possible. What we know we can do right now, to kind of say the serenity prayer, like what can we change right now? We can change the state of the movement in Iowa, in Colorado, in South Carolina, in Tennessee, Arizona, and that's what we're focused on right now. This is about pre-existing conditions. This is about health care in the midst of a health pandemic. On the 10th of November, there will be arguments at the Supreme Court about whether or not the ACA's protection of people with pre-existing conditions should stand. And let's be clear, the latest new big set of pre-existing conditions are, have you survived COVID-19? So we could literally have millions of Americans ultimately survive COVID-19 just to lose their health insurance because Donald Trump, Mitch McConnell pushed through another far right-wing justice before this election. This is going to be an intense fight. We have to worry about protecting Roe v. Wade, which Trump intends to overturn, to retaining our country's ability to at least one day be a real ally in ending climate change, protecting LGBTQ equality, protecting voting rights, a whole range of civil rights protections. And there are groups that care most about any one of those, but all of us, what we have in common is the need to protect our health. And so in this moment, we have to be clear that we are building a movement to make sure that the Supreme Court is not used by as a tool by Donald Trump, by Mitch McConnell, to gut the Affordable Care Act and to put Americans who have pre-existing conditions back in peril.
That was Ben Jealous, president of People for the American Way, who previously served as president and CEO of the NAACP. Find more perspectives on strategies to stop the GOP-controlled Senate from confirming President Trump's Supreme Court nominee by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Thus far in this early stage of this year's fire season, 5 times more acres in California have burned compared to last year's destructive fires. California Governor Gavin Newsom, talking with the press amid smoldering ruins of a burned-down home, declared, "This is a climate dam emergency." But activists and experts in California point out that Newsom's administration has been fanning the flames of the climate crisis. On September 21st, the Center for Biological Diversity notified Newsom of its intent to file a lawsuit to halt illegal permitting of oil and gas wells in California, whose emissions are a major contributor to heating of the atmosphere and to dangerous ground-level pollution. In a letter to the governor, the group said issuing such permits causes unacceptable climate and health harms and that the permits are being issued illegally without the review required under California's Environmental Quality Act. The number of permits given to fossil fuel companies in California was recently investigated by the group Consumer Watchdog and the Frack Tracker Alliance. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Lisa Tucker, advocate with Consumer Watchdog, about what they found. She says she'd like to see Newsom ban fracking, like Governor Andrew Cuomo did in New York in December 2014. However, New York had no fracking operations underway when Cuomo issued his executive order banning fracking in the state, later made permanent by the state legislature.
Governor Newsom, campaigned on a platform of being anti-fracking, said he didn't like it, and indicated he wanted to ban it if he were elected. And I think he came in and there was quite a lot of hopefulness that things were really going to take a sharp turn for the better in terms of actually limiting the drilling. Jerry Brown was a big booster of all of the incentives on the demand side, things like incentives for electric cars and really pushing renewable energy and getting it onto the grid. And of course, Newsom wants to continue that, and that's perfectly laudable. But it's one hand clapping if you don't do something to restrict the supply of oil. And so far, he has been a disappointment on that front. He has not lived up to what was expected, I think, by environmentalists.
What did your research turn up?
Nobody was tracking exactly how many permits were being dispensed by the Newsom administration until we started doing it. Our latest press release looked at the first 6 months of the issuing of oil and gas permits in California, and it found that specifically permits for new oil and gas production wells were up 185% from the first 6 months of last year.
And Gavin Newsom said he was very upset when he learned about that, right?
Precisely. I believe Newsom was genuinely unaware. I mean, he didn't know that, fracking permits had doubled. And since he wasn't a fan of fracking, he became very upset and he, fired the oil and gas supervisor in July when we came out with all of this. And then he quietly imposed a moratorium on the fracking. He didn't tell anybody. The permits that were hanging in the air, that the oil companies had applied for more fracking permits, those permits, and there were several hundred of them, were sort of put on ice. And what the administration did was it hired the Lawrence Livermore Lab to review these permits and to tell the administration whether or not they met the letter of the law, whether they met the regulations in California for approval. The administration didn't ask for a review of the permits in terms of the safety of the practice. So basically what happened, there's been a moratorium. It wasn't publicized. They started issuing fracking permits again. So, companies here are given, let's just say, a lot of slack. I would say that the regulatory agency here that oversees the oil and gas industry acts like a division of the oil and gas industry rather than like a regulator. The regulators themselves, many of them, come from the oil industry itself, and then they come into the agency, and, there's a revolving door.
Lisa Tucker, you also found information about other kinds of permits increasing, didn't you?
Overall, we found all permits, and there are many different kinds of permits for oil drilling. All of them are meant to enhance the amount of oil you're able to suck out of the ground. That number was around 9%. So the Newsom administration is going in the wrong direction. And we looked at several different categories. And what we said was we're very concerned about these regular oil and gas production wells that are being drilled because that produces oil that has emissions that are very, very dangerous to human beings. And we have in the state of California 5.5 million people, if you can believe this, who live within 1 mile of an oil or gas well, which is shocking, and nothing is being done about it.
Lisa Tucker, can you describe some of the health impacts of oil and gas drilling?
You have a lot of emissions of neurotoxic and carcinogenic hydrocarbons and volatile organic compounds and everything else. And in urban settings like Los Angeles, where we have the largest urban oil field in the country, there are communities that live here that are directly impacted by those sorts of emissions, which degrade air quality and can seriously impact health, which has been proven in numerous studies now. So we are very concerned with those, particularly with those oil and gas production well permit numbers. That's the 185%. We believe, based on analyses we've seen, that the governor could ban fracking via an executive order in order to protect the environment and the public health. Andrew Cuomo did it in New York with the stroke of a pen, and we don't see why Newsom can't do that here.
That was Lisa Tucker, advocate with the group Consumer Watchdog. Learn more about the campaign to stop fossil fuel fracking in California by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Just weeks before the U.S. presidential election, Trump's Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, announced a range of new unilateral sanctions and restrictions against Iranian officials and entities on September 21st. This came after the Trump administration's attempt to reimpose U.N. sanctions against Iran, which had been lifted under the Iran nuclear deal, failed to gain support from members of the U.N. Security Council. Nations on the Security Council rejected the sanctions because the Trump regime pulled out of the international nuclear agreement with Tehran in May 2018 and no longer has any legal authority to trigger those snapback sanctions. The president's executive order put in place a new arms embargo on Iran to replace a UN ban set to expire in October. Mr. Trump's move to increase economic pressure on Iran has escalated tensions and risks military confrontation in the final days of the November election campaign. Your reporter spoke with Trita Parsi, co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Here he talks about growing concern that the Trump regime may be trying to provoke a dangerous military confrontation with Iran in order to gain partisan advantage in the November election.
The United States under Trump administration is claiming that it has the ability to trigger UN sanctions on Iran, a mechanism that is called snapback that existed within the Iran nuclear deal. But the United States left the nuclear deal, the Trump administration did 2 years ago, and as a result has essentially lost the ability to be able to trigger those sanctions. That is the view of the vast majority of the states in the Security Council, that the U.S. no longer is a party to the deal and as a result cannot snap back sanctions. The Trump administration doesn't seem to care what other countries believe and has gone out and said that these sanctions have now been snapped back and that the U.S. will enforce them. Enforcing those sanctions means that the United States would be intercepting Iranian vessels or non-Iranian vessels that it accuses of having gone to Iran or coming from Iran. This has happened already on a few occasions, but they've all happened far away from Iranian waters. If the Trump administration actually starts doing this interception of these ships very near Iranian waters, meaning that the Iranian Navy will have an ability to strike back, there's a very significant likelihood that there will be a military confrontation somewhere in the Persian Gulf or the Strait of Hormuz between the United States and Iran. I think the faction led by Pompeo have long wanted to do this, but the elections seem to be giving him an opportunity since they have presented this in such a way that any such military confrontation would be seen as a legal and a defensive move by the United States. And I fear that the Pompeo faction is trying to convince Trump that if the election situation gets really bad, if they then do this provocation vis-a-vis Iran and end up getting some form of a military confrontation, it could serve him in the elections as an October surprise that could really upend the way things are going for him with the electorate.
Trita, you note that the United States people have rallied around the nation's president whenever there's an external threat or a conflict. Given that public opinion around the United States launching new wars, particularly in the Middle East, is at a very low point, if Trump thinks provoking a war with Iran will get him over the finish line to help him win re-election, is he mistaken in that? I mean, if people saw this as a transparent effort to assist Trump in his re-election, you would hope that the American people would reject the rally around the flag scenario.
Absolutely. And I think that's part of the reason why it's important to talk about this now, particularly mindful of the fact that Pompeo's hints about this have been quite explicit. But I think we also have to recognize that it is a bit of a human nature to do that type of rallying around the flag particularly if you end up having American casualties. Even when COVID broke out, even though it was clear from the beginning that the Trump administration was not handling it particularly well, the initial numbers show that actually his popularity and support went up. And this is not long-lasting, of course, but this is why we talk about October surprise. Well, if it's enough to bring him over the finishing line in the elections, the longer-term negative effect is of far less importance to him.
Right. Well, finally, I just wanted to ask you this. What, if anything, can we, as U.S. citizens, do right now to prevent such a dangerous conflict from erupting, whether deliberate or accidental, a conflict between the U.S. and Iran that could easily escalate into a bloody and very costly war?
Well, I think one of it is exactly what you're doing right now. The more we talk about the risk of these things and point out that this, unfortunately, is a potential path that they may choose, the more people are aware of this, the less likely it is that the administration would calculate that this would work. It feels very bad having to say all of these things because, I mean, under normal circumstances, one would think this is not the way government acts. Unfortunately, right now, it is. And we have seen, I mean, just take a look what happened today. A new set of sanctions designations were put on Iran. Usually these things are just announced with a press release, nothing more. This time around, there was a press conference with Pompeo, Mnuchin, Ross, the UN ambassador, O'Brien, the national security advisor, Epton, the secretary of defense, all giving essentially 2-minute speeches that had just repeated each other's talking points. It was clearly done for political reasons, to get maximum impact, to generate more support from whatever constituency it is that the Trump administration is trying to please with this kind of obsession they have with Iran. We're in quite a lot of bizarre scenarios. I would call it a bit of a twilight zone when it comes to all of this. And within that, unfortunately, this scenario of an October surprise is not an unlikely one. I'm not saying it's going to happen for 100%, but we have enough signs to say that we should be careful that this could be happening.
That was Trita Parsi, co-founder and executive vice president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Find a link to his recent article titled, "Is Mike Pompeo Preparing an October Surprise?" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Newton, Massachusetts, WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, WREK in Atlanta, Georgia, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mika Top. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.